Om Sahanavavatu, Sahanau Bhunaktu, Sahavidyan Karavavahai, Tejasvinavaditamastu ma vidvishavahai. Om Shanti, Shanti, Shanti. Om. Very good. Welcome back. Welcome also to many students who are attending these classes online. In the last class, if you thought it was a heavy class, it was, because in three verses, Sri Krishna unfolded the ultimate teaching of Advaita Vedanta. That was it. There's nothing beyond what he taught in those three verses. And what he taught, of course, was the fundamental reality, the ultimate reality, is present now. This is a different way of putting it. Let me try this, see how it works for you. What we understand to be the fundamental reality, the reality because of which everything exists, the reality we often call Brahman, that fundamental reality is present here now. Of course, in an intellectual way, you get it. Of course, everything is Brahmamaya. It is made of Brahman, so to speak. It's a manifestation of Brahma. But that fundamental reality is present in your experience in a much more direct way because the consciousness by which you know what's happening right now, the consciousness present in this experience, the consciousness that informs or reveals this experience right now, that consciousness is none other than the fundamental reality. That's a big deal. In fact, there's no bigger deal than that. Nice American English, right? It's a big deal. So anyway, you get it. Now, before we continue, after that teaching of the Mahavakya, the highest teachings of Advaita Vedanta, during the last class, I made a statement that a few people found surprising. I said, this fundamental reality is more real than Sri Krishna. And that statement needs to be clarified. That fundamental reality is more real than the baby Devaki gave birth to in Mathura. More real than the child who grew up and was chasing after gopis in Vrindavan. More real than the boy who killed Kansa. More real than the young man who counseled Arjuna on the battlefield during the Mahabharata. And more real than the Krishna who's talking to Uddhava right now in our Uddhava Gita. What needs to be clarified is Sri Krishna frequently refers to himself, especially in the Bhagavad Gita and Uddhava Gita, Sri Krishna refers to himself as that highest reality. After all, Sri Krishna is enlightened. He realizes that his truth is not the body that was born in Mathura. So when he says, I am the truth because of which everything exists, he's not referring to the physical body that was born to Devaki in Mathura. He's referring to his essential nature. So we really have to be careful and distinguish these two very different perspectives of Sri Krishna. At one level, he is an avatara, Ishvara in human form. And as Ishvara in human form is not the ultimate reality. But that ultimate reality is the truth of Sri Krishna, as it is the truth of you and me and everything else that exists. So at that higher level, we say that Sri Krishna is not as real as that fundamental reality, as that baby born in Mathura. Okay, with that clarification, we can pick up the thread. It's a nice place to pick up. Etad vidvan maruditam, etad vidvan maruditam, jnana vijnana naipunam, jnana vijnana naipuman, na nindati na chastauti, na nindanti na chastauti, loke charati suryavata, loke surati suryavata. So Sri Krishna, after those three amazing verses, he says to Uddhava, Mat Uritam, that which I said, which was jnana vijnana naipunam, which was filled with such powerful teachings about jnana, spiritual knowledge, and vijnana, you can say realization, enlightenment. So what I have told is that ultimate teaching of Advaita Vedanta, etat vidwan, and one who understands this highest teaching that has just been unfolded in the prior three verses, that person who understands, that person who is enlightened, na nindati na cha stauti, you can't use a word like curse in this, doesn't criticize or doesn't praise, that's okay. But even better, remember our discussion early in this chapter where we said that a wise person doesn't distinguish good and bad. In fact, we had a long discussion about how arbitrary these two words are, good and bad, and then a further discussion about how our tendency to separate everything in life into two categories, actually three, the two categories, desirable and undesirable. Then there's a sort of a third category, who cares? But but when you think about those items, you end up putting them usually in one category or the other. So we, just for the sake of simplicity, things that are desirable and those things that are undesirable, everyone has this tendency, everyone who's not enlightened has a tendency to care to categorize everything in that way. And the problem is, as soon as you categorize something as desirable, you want it, and you chase after it. And sometimes there are huge negative consequences of chasing after it. As a minimum, as long as you're chasing after those desirable things, you're not pursuing spiritual wisdom. You're not trying to get enlightened. You're running around in the world chasing after goodies. And conversely, as soon as you categorize something as undesirable, then you want to avoid it. And you work really, really hard at avoiding those things which are undesirable, which also has huge consequences. I'm not saying that you should avoid pleasant things, and I'm sorry, that you should not enjoy pleasant things, and you should not avoid unpleasant things. What we're saying is, when you let your life be molded by likes and dislikes, we're back to our topic, raga and dvesha. When you are compulsively driven by raga, when you are compulsively driven by dvesha, you're living the life not of an intelligent human being, you're living the life of an animal, right? That's how animals live. They go after things that they want, and they run away from things they don't want. We got this human birth, the highest birth possible, to make full use of this birth. We must break free of this compulsivity associated with raga and dvesha. Of course, the enlightened person is one who has done that. So Sri Krishna says that enlightened person, na nindati, na stauti, will paraphrase, doesn't categorize into good and bad, and is completely free from raga dvesha. And that enlightened person, loke, in the world, charati, moves about suryavat, like the sun. The metaphor of the sun, the sun shines equally on, the statement is the sun shines equally on saints and sinners. Sun doesn't categorize, the sun is not restrictive. So in the same way, the sun doesn't categorize who it shines upon or doesn't shine upon, the enlightened person doesn't categorize that which is desirable and undesirable. Then, pratyakshenanumanena, pratyakshenanumanena, nigamenatma samvira, nigamenatma samvira, adyantavara sadnyatva, adyantavara sagnyatva, nisango nichareriha, nisango vichareriha. Good. We'll do this verse in reverse. We'll do this verse in reverse order, starting with the last line. That one who is nisangaha, free from attachment. Attachment, remember, we define attachment in a very specific way. An object of attachment is an object whose presence or absence affects your contentment. That's a nice definition. It has an emotional consequence. In the presence of that which you're attached to, you feel good. In the presence of that which you're attached to not having, you feel bad. This is the raga dvesha part. So nisangaha then is necessarily, if you translate it as free from attachment, you're being literally correct, but more insightful to say free from raga and dvesha. Nisanga, free from attachment, means free from raga and dvesha. What about that person? Vicharet iha. Iha, here in the world. Vicharet, that person moves about, as like the sun, as Sri Krishna said in the prior verse. Why? How does that person come to transcend this raga and dvesha? You can't fake it, right? You have to discover the falsity of the basis for making these two categories. This is a little philosophical. This is Vedanta. This is Advaita Vedanta. When you put something in the good category, you consider the goodness of that object true and real. When you put something in the other category, you consider that object negative in quality, and those negative qualities are real and true, but how real are they? The enlightened person is one who adyantavat asat jnatva, the one who is jnatva, who has understood that everything that you call good and bad are asat. They're not absolutely real. How is it that they're not absolutely real? Adi antavat. They have a beginning and an end. Remember, our definition of real is that which doesn't change. Anything that changes ceases to be what it is. It's constantly changing. Its prior state of existence comes to an end when a new state of existence begins. So, in Advaita Vedanta, what is real is that which is beginningless, endless, and unchanging. Very, very, very carefully defined. And here's the point. If something is, this sounds very abstract when I say this, so let me start with a metaphor instead of sounding very abstract. The elephant chasing after you in your dreams, how real is it? You don't have to be afraid of that elephant. If you're wandering around in the hills near my guru's ashram in Coimbatore, which I used to do, and if you bump into a wild elephant, which I did, not physically bump into it, but came across an elephant, that elephant you better consider a little bit more carefully than the one in your dream. The point of this story is that which is not as real as you are can't hurt you, can't help you either, right? That which is as real as you are can hurt you or can help you. I gave the example of a glass of water next to your bed can't help you when you're thirsty in a dream. It has to be the same order of reality. And so this is very, look how profound these teachings of Advaita are. This is really not our, there's a lot that Sri Krishna has said in those three prior verses. I'm just hinting at it a little bit. Anyway, the enlightened person, asatnyatva, understanding that anything you're going to categorize is not as real as you. Therefore, if you're tempted to put it in a good category, why put it in a good category if it can't really help you? Like the water in your bedroom when you're asleep and thirsty. It can't help you. Or why put something in the negative category when it can't hurt you, like the elephant in your dream? So this is the vision of the enlightened person. Many people have the feeling like these teachings of Advaita Vedanta are so abstract, talking about fundamental realities. How can that possibly have a benefit in our day-to-day lives? I think based on our very brief discussion here, you get it. So now the last thing Sri Krishna, by the way, Sri Krishna is wrapping up his topic here. So last thing he says is, how do you gain that recognition of the unreality of everything you want to put in the good category or the bad category? How do you really get it that everything is adyantavat? Adi, beginning, anta, end. How do you get it that everything is transient? Well, you don't have to be a genius to figure that out. And Sri Krishna explains how you figure it out. And going up to the top of the verse now, he says you understand that through pratyakshena, pratyaksha, observation, whatever you see, hear, taste, smell, and touch. When you see something that's transient. The commentator gives the example of bubbles in the water. You see these little bubbles. In Sanskrit, they say bud bud. What a nice, sounds like bubble, bud bud. So these bubbles, how they get formed maybe when you pour some water, and then they last a few moments and they're gone. So, by the way, that's a metaphor given little sarcastically. It's a metaphor given for your life. Your life is like a bubble. But it just goes away. So, through perception, you understand the transience of everything in the world. Anumanena, through inference. Anumana, you can also get it. In fact, when you see the bubble pop, you realize, yeah, one day I'll be like that bubble and go away. So through reasoning and nigamena, nigama means scripture here. Through our scriptures, of course, everything Sri Krishna has been telling us here is to help us differentiate that this world is a transient, phenomenal reality, completely unlike the fundamental reality because of which everything exists. So nigamena, through scripture, we come to understand the transience of everything in the world. And finally, samvida. Samvid here, often it means consciousness. Here it means enlightenment. Through your own, not through your own, in the experience of an enlightened person. An enlightened person who knows, I am unchanging consciousness. And when you know, I am unchanging consciousness, you can look around and understand that everything else is less real than you. And a good metaphor for that, we've used this metaphor in previous classes, and the metaphor of a, what do they call it? A lucid dream. To be in a dream and to know it's a dream. Generally, dreams are not like that. But imagine having a dream, being a character in your own dream, and knowing it's a dream. You would know that everything in your dream world is not as real as you, the dreamer. Not the dream character. You, the dreamer. As a dreamer, you are more real than everything in the dream world. Therefore, nothing in the dream world can hurt you. Nothing in the dream world can help you. It's just, what else to say? It's just a dream. It's just an illusion. So this is Sri Krishna concludes now what it is to be enlightened by coming to understand this fundamental reality. Pretty profound stuff, exceedingly profound stuff. Not surprisingly, cousin Uddhava, nice expression you have, cousin brother. So Sri Krishna's cousin brother has a question, not surprisingly. Uddhava uvacha, Uddhava uvacha, naivatmano na dehasya. Naivatmano na dehasya samsrutir drashtra drishya yoho samsrutir drashtra drishya yoho anatma swadrishor isha anatma swadrishor isha kasya syarupa labhyate kasya syarupa labhyate. I think Uddhava demonstrates here, he's really understanding the profundity of what Sri Krishna has taught, and he's thinking in great depth about it, and he comes to a question, in fact, the same question that appears about every other day in my email inbox. Same question. Is Uddhava's question. Look at the question. He says, samsritihi, in the second line. Samsrit is a metaphor, is a synonym for samsara. Samsara means worldly life, worldly suffering. This life of worldly suffering, samsritihi, he says, na eva atmanaha. It doesn't really belong to Atma. Atma understood as the fundamental reality. The fundamental reality suffers in worldly life. That doesn't make any sense. So he says that the samsritihi, the suffering of worldly life, na atmanaha, doesn't belong to atma, na dehasya, nor does it belong to the deha. The physical body is a thing. Do things suffer? Does this chair suffer if I bang on it? And you say, but Swamiji, if you bang on your body, it suffers. Does the body suffer? Where does suffering take place? Not in the body. Everything takes place in our minds. So you can't say suffering belongs to the body. Then you say, oh, then it must belong to the mind. So body is sthula sharira. Remember these terms? Mind is part of sukshma sharira. If you say suffering doesn't belong to the physical body because it's just an inert thing, then you might conclude that suffering belongs to the subtle body, in particular to the mind. So imagine your mind, and this is only something you can imagine. Imagine your mind in the absence of consciousness. It's just a mental experiment. Imagine your mind in the absence of consciousness. Now, what's taught in our scriptures is that physical things, like the body, are made of five physical elements. Subtle things, like the subtle body, like the mind, are made of five subtle elements. Sthula bhutas are physical elements. Sukshma bhutas are non-physical elements. Your mind is made of those non-physical elements. In the absence of consciousness, in the absence of sentiency, can your mind suffer? Doesn't suffering require sentiency? Can you suffer in the absence of experience? Like if a tree falls in the forest with no one there to hear, does it make a sound? A little bit like that. Can you suffer without experiencing the suffering? Experience requires sentiency, requires consciousness. The mind itself is considered insentient, just like the body. The body is an insentient thing made of physical stuff. Your mind is an insentient thing made of subtle stuff. So now you understand that Uddhava's question is pretty interesting and challenging. Obviously, Atma, the fundamental reality, is not subject to suffering. But your physical and subtle bodies are also not in and of themselves subject to suffering. So at the end of the verse, he says, kasya syat upalabhyate. Kasya, for whom upalabhyate syat. For whom is this experience of suffering? Does consciousness experience suffering? That's tricky. You may think it does. We've said before, consciousness properly understood as a fundamental reality, that consciousness is unchanging consciousness. Can unchanging consciousness experience? Wouldn't experience require some kind of change? I'm not going to get into this. It's a huge topic, but this is the problem. Just as this clear crystal appears orange without truly being orange, consciousness appears to pick up the sadness of your mind. Here, the orangeness of the cloth represents the sadness of your mind. The orangeness of cloth appears in the clear crystal without affecting the crystal at all. Did the crystal change? Did the crystal become orange? Not at all. In the same way, the sadness of your mind seems to rub off on consciousness, but it really doesn't. This is a huge, important topic. We're not going to discuss it now. I'm just hinting at it. Many of you have heard this teaching before. If you haven't heard this, you should join our Vedanta class on Sundays. This is where we get into all these very important Vedantic teachings. So, consciousness does not suffer. Your body and mind being things don't suffer. So he says, kasya upalabhyate syat. Then who suffers? And he goes on to say that Atma doesn't suffer because Atma, look at the second line, Atma, the fundamental reality, is the drashtra, the seer in the middle of the line. And the body is drishya, seen. And that yoho is a dual ending. So Atma doesn't suffer because it's a seer means illuminator. Consciousness reveals what's happening in your mind without being affected by your mind. I'll say that again. Consciousness is the drashtra, seer, in the sense that consciousness reveals what's happening in your mind without being affected. Better example is the sun or light. This light shines on me, reveals orangeness. Does the light become orange? Is the light affected by this orangeness? Not at all. So Atma as drashtra, as seer, as observer, as sakshi witness, as revealer, it is unaffected. And your body is drishya. Drishya means seen. And anything seen is an object. You see the arm of the chair, it is an object. You see the arm of a swami, it is an object. Can you see your mind? Not see physically. Do you know what's happening in your mind right now? Figuratively speaking, your mind is known to you. Your mind is figuratively seen by you. Anything seen is an object. We make this fundamental distinction between subject and object. Awareful subject and inert objects. The awareful subject is not affected by what it sees. Like the light is not affected by this. So Atma doesn't suffer. And inert objects, things, no sentiency, no experience, no sensation. Uddhava makes one more connection. That the deha, Atma, in the third line, Atma is swadrik. Breaking the words apart. Swadrishoho, again dual. Atma is swadrik, self-shining. In fact, pure light, pure consciousness. Shining light, shining consciousness, which can't be affected by what it shines upon. And the body, deha, the body is anatma, unconsciousness, lacking consciousness. So unchanging consciousness can't be affected, and that which lacks consciousness can't experience. I'll say that one more time before we move on. Unchanging consciousness can't be affected by anything, therefore doesn't suffer. Anatma, that which lacks consciousness, can't experience anything, therefore can't suffer. Consciousness can't suffer because it doesn't change. The body, etc., can't suffer because it lacks consciousness. Kasya syat upalabhyate, then who suffers? Good question, right? That's why I get it every other day in my inbox. And that's why in every other... Well, not, In every other satsang I conduct, it comes up and it gets answered again and again. And I don't think that's going to stop anytime soon. And that's okay. Okay, let's continue. Atma vyayo guna shuddha. Atma vyayo guna shuddha. Swayan jyotiranavritaha. Swayan jyotiranavritaha. Agnivat daruvat. Daru varachat, agnivat daru varachat, deha kasyeha samsritihi, deha kasyeva samsritihi, kasya iha, here in the world, kasya samsritihi, who suffers? And he explains his question further. Uddhava says he's talking about Atma, first line, that fundamental reality. Uddhava is a good student. He's really understood well. He says Atma is avyayaha, unchanging. That which is unchanging doesn't get affected. Right now it's one color. Now it's orange. Crystal didn't change. So that which is unchanging is Atma. Therefore, it can't suffer. Atma is also agunaha, without quality. What color is this crystal? No color. That's what clear means, right? We say colorless. Agunaha, free from gunas. Atma is shuddha, pure, untainted. There's not a trace of orangeness in this crystal. The light shining on me doesn't pick up a trace of orangeness. That Atma is swayan jyotihi. It is self-shining. It is pure consciousness. And it is anavrittaha. It doesn't come, it doesn't go, it doesn't undergo rebirth. Atma, consciousness, was present before you were conceived, before you were born, and after you die. Unchanging means unchanging. That's what unchanging means. Before, after, and during. So, anavrataha. Never in a state of bondage. Atma never got into a state of bondage. And Atma is swayam jyotihi, it is self-shining agnivat, like fire. And here Sri Krishna uses a metaphor where you compare agni and daru. Daru is wood. When wood is burning, good question. What burns? Does fire burn or does wood burn? By the way, if you're a philosopher, you can spend years analyzing that. I don't think we want to get into the analysis, but certainly at a very simple level, there's a difference between fire and wood. Fire burns, wood is consumed. And the metaphor is consciousness illumines and mind and body and everything else are illumined. Experienced is even better. So fire burns. In fact, fire illumines the wood, does it not? Suppose it were dark and there was a pile of wood. Would you see it? If it's absolutely dark, you wouldn't see the wood. If the wood were on fire, you'd certainly see it. So the visibility of wood is due to fire, illumination. So here in the metaphor, consciousness is compared to fire. Your body and mind are compared to wood, inert. And that's what he says, dehaha, the physical body, is daruvat, like wood, the physical body is achit. It is not sentient. It lacks consciousness. So Uddhava asks his question one last time. Kasya iha samsritihi. Who suffers? There's another meaning of samsritihi. Travels. Samsriti, if you look in a dictionary, I'm sure samsriti will have a dozen meanings. One meaning will be samsara, which points to the suffering of worldly life, but definitely one meaning of samsriti will be travel. So who travels from one life to the next? Consciousness. Look at this. Can consciousness travel from one life? Consciousness has no edge or boundary. Consciousness is all-pervading. How can consciousness travel when it's already everywhere? Can't travel. Your physical body obviously doesn't travel. Actually, pardon me for making a bad joke. After death, your body does travel to the crematorium. What a bad joke. Oh, God. Man, that's about as bad as they come. All right. Please don't repeat that one. It's not very nice. Okay. Mind is a little trickier. Definitely the physical body doesn't travel from one life to the next. So we're still stuck with this question, who travels? And we're coming a little bit closer to it. And we'll come in just a moment. By the way, the same question was asked to Shankaracharya. And in one commentary, Shankara is famous in his commentary for a particular style. If you ask a question, he gives you first a very terse answer, sometimes so terse it's one word. And then that terse answer is followed by a much more elaborate answer. That's Shankara's style in all of his commentaries. Shankara's bhashyas have that style. So in one bhashya, he responds to the question, who travels or who for whom is enlightenment, for whom is suffering? And his first answer is one word, brilliant. Pritchuhu, for the one who asks. So if you ask, Swamiji, who travels? And you know, if you're like Uddhava, you understand, Swamiji, consciousness doesn't travel. Physical body is just stuff. It doesn't travel. Who travels? You do. The one asking the question. But now look at this. We said already, consciousness itself doesn't suffer. Body itself doesn't suffer. But go back to the wood metaphor. Look, wood, when it's burning, shines. Does wood shine? Does wood emit light? Here's some wood. If we turn off the lights, will this wood glow in the dark? No. Wood doesn't emit light unless it's on fire. Meaning, the combination of Agni and Daru, the combination of fire and wood is what burns. Combination. If you ask, is it A or B? Remember your multiple question tests? A, B, C, D. E is always all of the above. None of the above. Not all of the above. Suppose you had a question A, B, and C was both of the above. Could be, right? And that is the short answer. When Shankara says, Pruchuhu, the one asking you, are you conscious? Yes. Do you have a body and mind? Yes. A and B. Not A or B. A and B. This is why it's so confusing. The individual person, we use the word in Advaita Vedanta, the word jiva is used as a technical term. Generally, you know, in common parlance, anything that lives is a jiva. In Advaita Vedanta, we use it in a more refined way, a technical way. Jiva is the combination of consciousness plus body, mind. Or you leave out body, mind. But it's a composite entity composed as a minimum of consciousness and mind, and is therefore capable of experience. Look at this. Without consciousness, no experience. Without mind, no experience. In order for there to be any experience whatsoever, you need A and B, consciousness and mind, Atma and Sukshma Sharira. It is the combination that undergoes experience. It is a combination that is said to travel from life to life. It is a combination that suffers. It is the combination that we use the word jiva for in a technical sense. So we use the word jiva as a composite entity composed of both consciousness and, as a minimum, mind. All right, and that's the short answer, like Shankara gives, and now Sri Krishna is going to give us a much more elaborate and very profound answer. We'll just begin this part. Shri Bhagavan Uvacha, Shri Bhagavan Uvacha, Yavad Dehendriya Pranar, Yavad Dehendriya Pranar, Atmana Sannikarshanam, Atmana Sannikarshanam, Samsara Palavantavat, Samsara Palavantavat, Aparto Pyavivekinaha, Aparto Pyavivekinaha. Start in the third line. Samsaraha palavan. Samsara, worldly experience and worldly suffering, palavan. Bear fruit means as experienced, is what it means. Samsara palavan is experience. Samsara is experience, tavat, as long as what? Look in the first line. As long as, yavat, as long as you have a deha, indriya, and prana. You have a deha, physical body, indriya, senses. By the way, the mind is considered a sense organ, right? Antahkarana, the inner sense organ. So in addition to your five senses, the mind is also considered an indriya, sense organ. And of course, prana, life. Not a dead body, but a living body with senses and mind. So, do you have a living body along with senses and mind? Good. Me too. But that's not enough. When that body and mind and senses, sannikarshanam, is in the presence of Atma. Body, mind, and senses in the presence of consciousness. This is the answer. And this is what's been frustrating neuroscientists. They're going out of their minds. Honestly, they're struggling like anything, because you're studying the brain, trying to understand how the mind arises, and they can measure the physical characteristics of the brain. They can measure the interaction of neurons in the brain, which is That's how they define mind. And it's actually a scientifically accurate way of describing mind. In ancient times, they didn't understand anything about the brain and neuroscience, so therefore they say the mind was made of subtle stuff, sukshma bhutas. The mind is a non-physical, inert thing. That's how the ancients understood it. Modern science understands it. By the way, modern science doesn't accept non-physical things. Anything that exists is a physical thing. So science doesn't differentiate between sthula and sukshma. Instead, science says that mind is the function of the neurons in your brain, the interactions of the neurons in your of your brain is mind. Mind is the function of the brain. And they're getting better and better at understanding the function of the brain, and the mind that arises because of the function of the brain. But these poor scientists, I'm making kind of a bad joke about it, these poor scientists are frustrated because they can't measure or observe the consciousness by which thoughts are known. Notice that the scientists are only measuring brain activity. Brain activity is not the same. This is just for fun. This is a big, we're not going to go here because I will finish this verse and finish the class. But here's a funny question. Are you, right now, are you experiencing thoughts and sensations and emotions? Are you experiencing the contents of your mind right now? Or are you experiencing brain activities? By the way, there are some philosophers who answer the latter very seriously. They say, this is actually a modern theory. You are experiencing brain activities, but you are deluded into thinking that it's a mind. How's that? Kind of unintuitive, but there are some philosophers who cling to that stuff. Anyway, the point I'm making is that we understood the mind very differently in Shankara's time. We understand the mind very differently in modern times. That changes. What doesn't change is the knownness of the mind. The knownness of the mind was consciousness. In Shankara's time, the knownness of the mind is the same today, and that's what's frustrating these neuroscientists. So the experiencer, the one who has experience, the jiva, is due to the combination, sannikarshanam, the combination, association of atmanaha, of consciousness, with the deha, physical body, indriya, senses and mind, and prana. This is the jiva, and that is the experience, experiencer. The last line. So this samsara is experienced by whom? Last word of the verse, avivekinaha. You have to break apart the words. Api avivekinaha. Aviveki is one who doesn't understand, one who can't discern what is consciousness, what is mind, what is body. And so that unenlightened person experiences samsara, worldly suffering, apartaha api, even though that suffering is unreal. Now, this is a whole new topic, so we're going to save it for our next class. But just to show where Sri Krishna is going with it, we're done with this. So what is the, in fact, yeah, Uddhava's question is answered. It's over. And that is, who suffers? who suffers is the one who experiences what's required for experience as a minimum, consciousness plus some kind of mind. Okay, so his question is answered, but now Sri Krishna is about to go off in a whole different direction, back to his topic about fundamental reality. And he says that samsara that you experience is not a fundamental reality. And now we have the question, how does something that's unreal give rise to experience? How does something unreal give rise to experience? That's actually very easy to answer, but we'll see it much more elaborately in our next class. The short answer is, what about that rope snake that scared you in the dark alley? You experienced suffering due to a non-existent snake. Or has anyone ever played the joke on you with a, like a rubber snake? They throw it at you and you, ah! Because you think it's a real snake. Well, you suffered because of an unreal snake. That which is, look at the irony of this. You suffer because of things that are unreal. This is Advaita Vedanta. Unreal things make you suffer. You can see where Sri Krishna is going with this, back to this fundamental reality. That's what we'll see in our next class. A couple of quick announcements here at the end of today's class. I mentioned before that our musical meditation sessions are resuming. We used to have once a month a musical meditation before the pandemic, and we didn't resume it until now. This coming Wednesday at 7 p.m., musical meditation will resume. It's use of raga, musical melodies, together with mantras and some stotras to create just a beautiful meditative mood. So come join us on Wednesday. And of course, tomorrow, Sunday, we have our Vedanta class at 10 o'clock, followed by question-answer satsang at 11. So please come join us. We'll conclude with our prayers.
Om Gananaham Tva Ganapatigam Vamahe Kavingavinam Hupamashravastamam Jeshtarajam Brahmanam Brahmanaspatahana Shrinvan Utibhisvid Sarinam Om Mahaganapataye Namaha Ishvaro Gururatmeti Murti Bheda Vibhagine Vyomavad Vyapta Dehaya Dakshina Murtaye Namaha Vasudeva Sutam Devam Kamsachanura Mardanam Devaki Paramanandam Krishnam Vande Jagat Guru Om Sarve Bhavantu Sukhinaha Sarve Santu Niramayaha Sarve Bhadrani Pashyantu Ma Kashchid Dukha Bhag Bhavet Asato Ma Sadgamaya Tamasoma Jyotirgamaya Mrityorma Amritangamaya Om Shanti 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 Om Tat Sat.